Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Data, analytics, big data science, machine learning, customer insight, behavioral science, blockchain, data ops, data engineering, agile working. Phew, too many terms, too many things to think about. Do you as a leader need somewhere to turn? To hear what other leaders are doing? To hear what really makes a difference in your business? Welcome. The Customer Insight Leader Podcast is here for you. Each episode, we'll be interviewing a different leader in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics to hear what they really do, what really makes a difference. So settle down, get that cup of coffee, and enjoy the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Hello and welcome back to Season 2 of the Customer Insight Leader Podcast, a place to hear from today's leaders in the fields of data, customer insight, data science, analytics, and AI. As I shared in the preview episode for this season, a new emphasis in these conversations is we'll also be digging a bit deeper into some of those all-important softer skills. I'm your host, Paul Loughlin, and with me today is Dr. Simon Dewey. Simon is currently the VP leading data and analytics at Asda, the leading retailer here in the UK. And like my last guest, David Merrick, Simon also has decades of experience in the industry. As we'll hear, he learned his trade at some of the biggest names in the worlds of analytics, particularly for the retail sector. And like a few of my past guests, Simon also has experience of both technical and commercial leadership roles and of moving globally in developing those roles and those skills in himself. So I'm sure we're going to touch on both those themes as well. I first worked with Simon, unbelievably, in the last millennium when I was at Lloyds Bank and he was working at Quadstone. Even then, I remember Simon impressing me with his communication skills, his confidence, his commercial language, coupled with his technical knowledge. So it's great to still be in touch and have this time to hear from him again. Welcome, Simon.
Thank you so much, Paul. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Great. Good to have you as a guest too. Looking forward to this conversation. I'm sure it won't just be nostalgic. It'll be interesting to really explore some of the learning you've had along the way. With all my guests, Simon, I like to start by asking them to tell us their backstory, if you like, so listeners know where they're coming from, the experience they've got to draw on. So, time-honoured fashion, let's do the same. Can you please tell us about your career story? How have you developed into the role that you've got today?
Yes, with pleasure. Your introduction made me feel incredibly old.
I'm sorry, Simon.
That's okay. Quite recently, I was giving another presentation and somebody introduced me as a data science veteran. But I don't know if it really came across that way. So yes, my history. So I have been working in data science in some shape or form for 25 years, essentially. I started off in quite a technical job family. So I graduated with a degree and then subsequently a PhD in computational and statistical physics. I made a jump from what was doing computer simulations of fluids into computer simulations of people, essentially. Okay. And that's where you and I worked together when I was working in Quadstone. So Quadstone were an analytical software company who really pioneered some of the early work on how you apply massively powerful computing techniques to understanding customer behavior. I worked with Sainsbury's and the launch of their reward scheme and all of the analytics that can spawn. I joined a consultancy called Peppers and Rogers Group in Crikey. This must be about 2001 or two, which was fascinating. Somebody who I always saw my strengths as very numeric, being good at translating commercial problems into maths problems and then finding the right way to solve those maths problems. In a company like Peppers and Rogers, who are a strategic consultancy, it was a wonderful exposure to higher levels within business and more strategic thinking within business. I stayed with them for about 3 or 4 years and then joined Dunnhumby, were Tesco's, or remain Tesco's, analytical wing. And I joined them in 2005. I spent 3 years working in the UK, and then had what at the time was the opportunity of a lifetime, and moved to Shanghai in 2008. There for 11 years, doing a variety of roles. And then I had another wonderful opportunity to move to Sao Paulo, where I headed up the dunnhumby business across Latin America. Then my most recent move was back to the UK, and then leaving dunnhumby and into Asda in January just last year, 2023. So I've been here for about 15 months now. And I would broadly say, like, you could split my career into two halves. So for the first 10 to 15 years, I remained very technical, hands-on coder. Fortran, if you, well, I'm sure you will remember such a thing, Paul, if I can.
Yes, indeed.
Fortran and Perl and C++ and then SAS and then Python. And then for the most recent 10 years, much more as you kind of described in the introduction, as a manager and a leader, and in many respects, a general manager. So running the dunnhumby business in Latin America was, you know, full responsibility for P&L, for sales teams, for marketing teams. So lots of very interesting experiences outside of pure analytics. My most recent role in Asda, very stimulating, very challenging. But how do you use data analytics to maximize the decision-making efficacy of a large retailer with objectives to grow sales, grow margin, grow customer loyalty?
Makes sense. Great. Thank you, Simon. Really, really nice and concise. And as you say, there's a lot in there. I mean, I'm struck, and I was struck when first hearing your story again. What big names in the industry you've worked with? You know, I mean, Don Peppers and Martha Rogers, and then Dunnhumby. They're some of the great big pioneers in the whole world of CRM and the application of data analytics to those worlds. You've been kind of behind the scenes. Was it as good as the pitch? You know, are these agencies really pioneering in their thinking, or were they just really good at marketing themselves as good at this stuff?
Oh, well, that's a brilliant question. I think to be a successful entrepreneur, which both of those organizations and the leaders of those organizations, the founders of those organizations were, you have to have both. So you have to have a unique vision, and then you have to have the self-belief, and, you know, let's not shy away from it, even the ego, that promotes that vision. And Don Peppers and Martha Rogers, you know, they did lay down a lot of the foundations for what is now commonplace in terms of one-to-one marketing and personalization. But Don, and I don't think he would mind me saying this if he reads the podcast, he was the consummate salesman, loved the whole kind of theater of selling and the pitch, and loved being front and center in that theater. I think I'm right that one of the earliest books that he wrote was titled Life's a Pitch and Then You Die.
And he's written a few. He's written a few since, yeah.
Rises his mentality a lot. And then Clive and Edwina, just what a powerful partnership they were. The technical professorial brain that Clive had, combined with the commercial instincts and drive that Edwina bought. Fascinating power couple to have spent time with.
Brilliant. And given the themes, the blend in a way in your own career, Simon, do you see yourself as having sought to develop both those skills and then being a key to your success? Would you see yourself as both a commercial entrepreneurial person and a technical visionary? Are you equally both tribes, I suppose?
I'm not sure I would describe myself as entrepreneurial as those individuals. You know, they kind of stand apart.
Sure.
It's definitely a theme in my career, and I would encourage this for listeners who are starting out in data analytics. To lean heavily into the commercial sides of data and analysis and to really understand in minutiae the challenges that you're being asked to solve with numbers. I would say there's a quote which I probably overuse, but that the right answer is never enough. And it can almost be damaging to have an answer which is too right and too because you then have over-focused on the mathematical rigor of a solution rather than the kind of the practical side of the problem that you're trying to solve. And in my experience, much more than 50% of creating an impact with the work that we do is around the embedding of it and getting the business stakeholders who are ultimately going to be the consumers of our output engaged to a point that they understand the solution, they trust it enough to be able to rely on it when it might, in occasions, kind of go against their instincts. They don't immediately throw it out, but they think, well, why? Yeah. I think your point is well made that definitely in my career I've tried to go out of my way to understand the commerciality of the work that we're doing and see that as important, if not more important, than the technical side of it.
Yeah, that makes good sense. I can see that as a theme and thoroughly echo that ethos. I would agree completely in what I've learned as well. Like a number of the guests I've had on this podcast, it surprised me actually how many in the data leadership community this is true of. You've moved internationally and taken opportunities around the world. I wonder, often guests will say that that's helped them develop as a leader. Following on the theme I've just explored with you, I wonder, do you see your international moves as helping you develop your technical skills, or has it been more that they've developed your commercial or your leadership skills, or all three, if you like? What have you gained from all this moving around the world, Simon?
Yeah, I would say it's definitely on the leadership skill that it's helped, other than the technical side, and experiencing some very different cultures. So spending a lot of time in China, and when I was in China, I worked extensively in India and in Japan, and a little bit in Indonesia and Thailand and other Southeast Asian countries. Right. Then also across Latin America. That kind of how you see connections between people who can think very differently from yourself and often express themselves in a very different way than you're used to, or that you're kind of used to in your social, your work setting in the UK or in other countries. Right. It's been brilliant. And it's and at the one point it's just a fascinating experience to go through.
Yeah, of course.
And it's very powerful in developing a sense of empathy and seeing commonalities between people whose backgrounds are extraordinarily different and cultures are extraordinarily different. Then this is going to sound kind of very philosophical, but then seeing the shared humanity and the shared experience, even across such very different cultures, definitely helps a better leader. You know, so much of leadership is about empathy. That if you can see that commonality across different cultures, it just helps you with your instincts around empathy.
That's a well-made point. I think you're absolutely right about that. I mean, you're preaching to the choir in some sense, since I'd echo what I've learned as a trustee of a refugee charity as well, coming across and interacting with people from such a diverse range of cultures opens your eyes and opens your heart in some ways as well. But yeah, no, good point about the key of empathy as a leader. I think that's under stressed.
Yeah. And I remember, you know, first interactions where you were, I believe you were at Lloyd's at the time. You definitely, because I remember interacting with some of your team, you role model that kind of empathetic approach to leadership, that you get the best out of people when they feel they're working for a boss, a manager, a leader who's got their back, who understands them, strengths and weaknesses.
Great. That's good. Good to hear. Thank you very much. That's very kind. Another thing I guess I noticed that stood out to me as a little different in your career story is the greater portion of time being hands-on technical. A number of the senior leaders that I've had on this podcast left that behind a little earlier in their career. Not all, and some remain to some extent hands-on and clearly scientists to this day, but on average, people hadn't been hands-on for quite so long. I wonder whether you feel now, with the benefit of hindsight, that it's a good thing that you stayed hands-on for longer and maybe to some degree hands-on still, or whether you think it hindered you and you should have let go and just been a leader for longer. What's your view on that aspect?
Oh, I think that's fine. Speaking for myself, I couldn't have transitioned any sooner. I would not have been ready. Mm. I think that's probably the advice I would give to other people is don't force it.
Yeah.
I'll give you quite a personal example. So when I was in China, I had the opportunity to step away from being the technical lead and become the commercial lead, which I did for a couple of years. This would have been about 2010 or 11. And I really didn't enjoy it. And I don't think I was very good at it. Because it was too soon. Mm-hmm. I'd forced it through for a couple of years, but then was very relieved when I had the opportunity to go back into, it was a pre-sales role, but it was definitely more technical.
Yeah.
I relished for probably a further 3 or 4 years, and then had another opportunity to go back into commercial. And having gone through what was a very painful experience, mm-hmm. I had my eyes open. I could kind of go in knowing, well, this is parts of it which I'm good at. This is the part of it which I found difficult the last time, mm-hmm. or needs to get over that difficulty. And it was a much better experience, and it's kind of, you know, spurned me on from that and taken me into bigger leadership roles, general manager in Latin America and the VP in ASDA. So, yeah, for me, wouldn't have been a question. I wouldn't have been ready to move any sooner. And I would very much advise people who are looking to make that transition not to force it. Mm-hmm. You move soon, you're going to regret it.
Yes, very good advice. Thank you, Simon. And thank you for being so vulnerable and personal about it as well. I echo it from people even that I mentor and coach, that you do see that some people feel under the pressure to force things to achieve certain roles by certain deadlines. And I think you're absolutely right not to force it and to seek to develop a good level of self-awareness around your own strengths and weaknesses. That can be so key.
It's a funny thing because one of the skill sets that I think people from our background misjudge is simple things like understanding a P&L sheet. So, you know, P&L sheet, write it in one page of Excel. There's lots of numbers on it, and people from our background think, oh, well, you know, I'll be able to get my head around that, no problem at all. But a good commercial person, that they will have instincts that will just lead them to spot problems, opportunities, tell a story from a P&L or a trend of P&L lines that takes time to build up. Those instincts, they're very different from the skill sets of the data analysts. I've seen people in my background who've made that transition and really struggled because of that kind of precept. I'll be able to get my head around sales targets, sales forecasts, P&L sheets, and just not being able to, the instincts just not being there.
Yeah, and it's very, very well put. I think there is sometimes within our community a lack of humility of realizing that finance and commercial and even sales skills are genuine skills that have a bunch of knowledge and years of practical experience to hone as well. And there's stuff to learn there. It isn't just other forms of numbers.
Yeah, exactly right.
The thing that surprised me when we chatted previously is that even places, and I've heard this from other data leaders working in retail, that pioneered to some extent applications of data analytics, like the large retailers, are now seen as less sexy as places to work for the new generation coming through. You know, they want to work at the and Magnificent Seven and the tech companies. I suppose it took me by surprise, because when I was learning my trade, you know, you'd to some extent look on enviously at Tesco's and the others with the volume of data they had. We weren't short of data in a bank, but retailers seem to be a great place to apply analytics skills. Am I right that you're finding a new generation don't think going and working at a retailer is sexy? And if so, how do we win over the data scientists that it's a great place?
I think you are right. There is an allure that comes along with big tech, the Facebooks, the Googles, the X's, etc. And I think it's a misunderstanding, frankly, that people who go into those businesses will be surrounded by the best of the best, and they'll be working on the latest theories and techniques. And what I think that fails to take into account is the quality of the data asset. Really is very few, if any, data assets out there that enable such a deep understanding of customers and their behavior and what people choose to put into their shopping basket. Immensely powerful in understanding what motivates an individual, what they like, what they don't like. That makes it such a rich source for data analytics, and retail is almost never ending in the opportunities it offers to make changes within the store environment. You know, the typical, you think of the degrees of freedom that exist in the store with 30,000, all of which can have, well, will have different prices and different promotions and different locations and different provenance. The amount of flexibility of data science has to make changes and recommendations in that environment is it's near infinite as you would want it to be. And I think it's a misunderstanding. I think maybe the industry, the retail industry, hasn't done a good enough job in promoting itself and promoting why for a serious data scientist working with that kind of data set really should be an issue.
Yeah, no, I would completely agree, Simon. I think a number of the senior data leaders that I know at retailers as well, that they've attracted some of the great brains in the business. So there's every reason to say, you know, think about it. This is a great place to work. Let me come on to the theme I've tried to emphasize a bit more in this second season of the podcast, which is the softer skills that have helped leaders like yourself. And I've chosen this as an emphasis because I think it's neglected still. And most people assume that successful data and analytics leaders have mainly got there because of their technical expertise. A misconception I think is even worse in these days of data science and AI being the main thrust. So I like to, in conversation with people like yourself, draw out the softer skills, the people skills, the leadership skills that have been key to your success as well. So I'll ask you the same, Simon. As you've taken a bit of time to reflect over all these many years, you're not old really, I wonder if you've noticed a softer skill that's really served you well, something you recognise has made a difference to your development.
Yes. I mean, I'll start my answer with just acknowledging that the technical skill set is important. You know, I've worked in environments where teams of data analysts have been managed by people without a data analytics background. And yeah, it's not that it can never work, but it's tough. It's tough to command the of data scientists, data practitioners, if you don't have some skill in the field. I think it's better if you do come from that background. You'll just find it more comfortable. You'll relate more to your team if you've got some experience in that. And the softer side, though, it's been a journey of leadership discoveries, and there's been a few maxims that I've kind of, if I'm being honest, when I first heard them, thought they were a little bit trite, but actually have come back to me at various times they've really, really captured it. Share a couple. One would, leading about being able to deal with contradiction. So for example, you need to double your productivity, but you need to half your workforce. Kind of competition. That's an extreme, but you know, it's also extreme. So you've got to do more with less, and that's the scene. You need to improve morale of your team, but we're taking away 50% of your entertainment budget, those kind of things. Leadership is about not questioning that too much, accepting that it's your job as a leader to internalize those contradictions and be able to deal with it. There was another great one, which an old boss of mine talked to. You know, he was asked, well, what are the traits of a good leader? And his answer was, yeah, it's so hard. It's so hard to really identify and pin down. If you do X, Y, and Z, then that will make you a good leader. After a bit of thought, he said, probably the one thing that all leaders have to have is energy. And you can be loud and domineering. You can be quiet and a bit of an introvert. You could still be a good leader. You need the energy. Obviously, like vision, being very clear on what you're there to do as a leader in a way that you can articulate to your team, and very clear on what that will mean for them, and for the perception of the team, and you know, in our case, the value that's going to create for the business. Empathy has always been very big one for me. Have to walk in the shoes of the people that you are managing. You've got to be able to understand the challenges that they're being faced with, so that you respect that and you're there to help and support. You can't be a pushover, though. I'm not a big fan of a phrase that has crept in recently of the servant leader. That smacks of kind of false humility.
I know what you mean in terms of the overuse of it. I think some of the original authors, I would agree with their intention, but it can become the leader wanting to be the friend when the leader sometimes needs to be the one taking the tough calls and holding the line.
Yeah, exactly right. And it's right and proper to be a friend, but you always have to have in your back pocket or the back of your mind, there are times when you're going to need to crack the whip a bit and you will not be as strong a leader. The one that surprised me and continues to surprise me is instincts. And I find myself sitting in meetings, and I literally catch myself every time I do it, saying things like, I can't prove this, but my instinct says this is the right thing to do. And coming from a very numerate technical background, I always think, is that okay? Shouldn't I be the person that is proving this? I can't rely on instincts and feelings. I need to rely on numbers and data. But I've got really comfortable with it and very now confident in, after 25 years of working in the field, and I'll say I've seen every single challenge, but I've seen a lot of them. And you know, the brain is a marvelously non-linear machine. And the manifestation of that non-linearity is instincts. Perfectly fine to say, I can't prove this, but every fiber in my body is saying this is the right thing to do. And trust your instincts. So that's the surprising one. And I still kind of catch myself now when I sit in meetings and use the phrase, but it's right. It's okay to trust your feelings and your instincts.
Yeah, it is an interesting one, isn't it? Thank you for sharing that, Simon, because in the one sense, you've got, for a number of us who've been trying to transform organizations over the years, you've got this gut instinct was the very thing we were kind of warring against. We were saying, be data-based in your decisions. And yet I can absolutely relate to, had coming to my mind that whole model from unconscious incompetence all the way through to unconscious competence. And in a way, maybe we're just talking about the translation of the conscious competence into unconscious competence, that you reach a stage at which all your expertise and the different problems you've seen to some extent become unconsciously codified. And that manifests, as you say, through your instinctual response to a situation.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a powerful lesson that in our line of work, rarely are all the answers in the data. You know, there are certain problem which you can just throw a computer at with the right data. You know, what is the optimal pricing policy over a list of 10,000 SKUs? You need a computer. What is the right product to market to different people? You need a computer to answer that. But many of the more strategic questions, what lever should I pull to maximize my sales over the next quarter? The data can never answer with the accuracy. You'll never have perfect data to be able to answer it, and you'll never have a perfect technique to be able to answer it. So that reliance and fallback onto confident instincts is super important.
Yeah, no, that makes good sense. What a great example to share. I don't think I would hear it from many, but I can see you're right. I wonder, I've explored with some of the others where they've learnt to hone or be inspired in the development of their softer skill by role models. Is there anybody you've worked with over the years that you feel has been a real role model that you've seen? Actually, I see them making great judgment calls by instinct. I can see there's a place for this.
Yeah, many. I'll name two. I don't think they will mind me naming them. I never worked particularly closely with her, but Edwina had wonderful commercial instincts. She would see opportunities where other people could not, and she was so strong at intuiting the best line of attack to go after. And very charming with it, as kind of strongly commercial she was. She had a wonderful charm.
Great comment.
Much more directly, I work with, she was actually my boss in China for 2-3 years, maybe more, a lady called Karen O'Regan, who again, I hope she doesn't mind me mentioning her, and seeing how she interacted with colleagues, both internally, and this was in Dunnhumby at the time, but also clients, was a masterclass in how to manage meetings and expression manage people sounds a bit coarse, but you know, softly influence people in the right way. Yeah. It would be able to kind of go in with, this is what I'm looking for in this certain situation, and very kind of deftly, with a lot of guile, a lot of charisma, be able to get people to do things or say things or feel things which they probably didn't really intend to going into the meeting. Real masterclass in how to read a room say the right things in the right situation.
Great. Very helpful background for letting your instincts loose then. The other thing I like to do where people have shared a softer skill that's really helped them, and thank you so much for this instinct, Simon, because I don't think that's going to crop up with a lot of data leaders, is to think about the limits of it as well. So positive and negative examples. Do you have a positive example where your willingness as well as your skill in listening to your instincts really helped you make the right decision? And do you have any situations you're willing to share where it hasn't worked well, or you'd say, well, don't go by instinct in that scenario?
Oh, crikey. Where it goes well, a lot of the time it's a person thing. And I think it comes to the fore in interview situations and recruitment. And I would say when I was in Latin America in Sao Paulo and essentially had to create a new leadership team, not quite from scratch, but not far off. This was 4 weeks into my time in Latin America. Wouldn't say I had a particular understanding of the culture. And pretty big calls on who to bring into the leadership team. That was a very instinctual situation. Does this person feel right? On paper, they tick a lot of boxes. Do they feel? And I remember there were two candidates for a particular role. I won't go into too much of the detail of it.
Sure.
One was much more senior, much more seasoned, much more experienced. The other one was younger, a bit greener, but had just bags of positive energy and get up and go about them. And you know, instinct said, go with that one, go with the person who is less experienced, but seems to fit the mold of the personality type that you need. And that paid back in spades. That was a very wise decision, if I can batter myself.
The other thing I like to cover in most of these episodes, Simon, is to think about those of our listeners who are a little earlier in their careers. So when I've done the simple analytics based on much more limited data than a good retailer would have, it seems about 50-50 in my audience of people who are younger and earlier in their career and people who are more at the sort of senior data leader kind of level. So to give some more consideration toward those who are starting out, I wonder, given so many years experience now and the number of people you've recruited and been developing over those years as well, what would your tips be to the next generation? Well, for those who are starting out now in data careers, what's your bit of advice for them?
Yeah, I mean, what a great time to be joining the data science family with all advances in, and I'll say Gen AI rather than AI, and probably within the lifetime of the next generation of data scientists, we're going to see quantum computing hitting the mainstream in another very revolutionary way. Fantastic time to be joining the field. Advice that I would give, I talked about it at the start of the conversation, is go out of your way and make every effort to engage with the consumers of your work, the people who are going to be making decisions on the back of the analytics that you're doing. Try and walk in their shoes, understand their challenges, their barriers, as much as you can about the constraints that they operate under. It is so easy, and it happens in so many organizations, that you see these barriers built up between the technical communities and the commercial business communities, and there's levels of distrust, and you know, one side thinking, oh, they're just a bunch of idiots who don't understand this, and
other yes,
well, who are they to teach me about how to buy soft drinks, for example. A good data scientist has to break through those and develop a level of trust and respect consumers of the work that they're doing. On the technical side, I would say, look, try and get exposed to as many different applications of your work as possible. And by doing that, you'll also get exposed to a lot of different techniques, approaches. But don't be too seduced by the appeal of trying out lots of different algorithms, mathematical techniques to approaching a problem. Are almost always having better data is going to lead to a better answer than using a more sophisticated technique. We'll talk about this for a long time, actually, Paul. I'll say the next one. The power of the explanation, and you can have built a massively sophisticated model that you're super, super proud of. If you cannot explain how it works in terms that a non-technician can understand, the chances of it being adopted decrease dramatically and completely go away. Like, things can be mandated. But gaining people's trust in the work that you've done is super, super important. And don't be ashamed of being very honest about where the data runs out or where there's a flaw in the model or the techniques that you've built. Don't feel that you have to have answered everything with absolute rigor. The answers aren't always exclusively in the data, and there is very rarely any such thing as the perfect model. And you can actually gain a lot of credibility and a lot of trust about being super honest about the strengths and the weaknesses. Now, having said that, that is not an excuse for sloppiness.
No.
Strive to build the best model and answer the questions fully and as properly as you can.
Yeah, no, I hear that, Simon. But I think it's a great summation, actually, of a number of themes in our conversation, that the focus is it helping. The focus is the difference it makes to the the internal customer, the part of the organization you're seeking to serve. And I hear in it themes of empathy, themes of trust and relationship and influencing, themes of instinct and pragmatism, because it isn't about even the better data that I agree with you will almost always make the biggest difference, yeah. or the cleverness of the technique. It's about you did help solve this problem, improve this process, have a better offering. And actually, we should be obsessed as data leaders with making a difference and helping, not with how clever we think we are.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. This is quite a crude segmentation, but I tend to see people in our line of work sitting into two camps or exist at least operating on a spectrum. Mm. Where people who get their energy and excited and want to work on the latest technique and the most advanced stats that's available. And you know, they see the world of a data scientist as being like the uber geek, if you like.
Yes.
And on the other side of the spectrum, there's people who get their energy from, well, I want to see my work resulting in action. I want to see the value that it's created. I want to see the change that it's created. And I get my energy from seeing that action happening. It don't matter if my work has been a really advanced Bayesian neural network or if it was just a crosstab. My energy is... I want to see it in action. I think most data scientists sit somewhere on that spectrum. And actually, if really kind of being honest, I think most data scientists are quite polarized. They're at one side of that spectrum or the other side of that spectrum.
Yeah.
And our world has space for both types and certainly needs both types.
Yes, yes, yes. And I think it's quite astute. Well, in this conversation, Simon, we have definitely waved a flag for the energized by making a difference and helping people into the spectrum and the commercial thinking side of that as well. So that's great. Thank you for your thoughts. Thank you for your openness. And many thanks for your time today, Simon. It has been a delight to chat with you.
It's a great pleasure, Paul. And thank you for hosting and running these podcasts. It is a wonderful community to be part of.
Great. Thank you. And thank you everyone for listening. I hope you found that helpful and continue to listen to the Customer Insight Leader podcast. More great interviews coming up. And there's also content on our blog, customerinsightleader.com. So you might want to check that out too. Before then, it just remains for me to say thanks once again to everyone for your time. Have a great week. And perhaps you can reflect this week on that instinct that Simon talked about. What might it mean for you as a leader this week to trust your instinct, to focus more on the commercial decision that's needed rather than needing to be able to prove it from data? A radical thought for the week, maybe. Bye for now.